WNYC Studios is supported by Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, where hundreds of researchers make new discoveries inspired by the work of previous Dana-Farber scientists. Learn more about their momentum at danafarber.org/everywhere.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's Brian Lehrer, and this is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Wednesday, April 8th. As the pandemic peaks in New York and around the country, there are also glimmers of hope in the long-term numbers. We'll talk about those paradoxical statistics this morning. But the warnings from public health officials to stay home this week are even more intense than before. And I want to make sure you've heard that call. The mayor of Los Angeles, Eric Garcetti, is now telling agencies, if you must go shopping this week, you'll be required to cover your face. And remember, that's to protect others if you're asymptomatic but affected, even more than to protect yourself. And I want to play a longer than usual soundbite. This is over 2 minutes. To begin today, of Dr. Deborah Birx from the White House Coronavirus Task Force, who urged Americans for this week to not even go shopping at all. At the White House briefing on Monday, she gave an emotional and very personal answer when asked why she went that far.
You know, out of respect for every single healthcare worker that's on the front line, whether they're a nurse, a doctor, a respiratory therapist, the phlebotomist, the persons who come in the rooms to clean, you know, out of respect for them, we as Americans should be doing everything possible. And what I meant was, if you can consolidate, if you can send one person, the entire family doesn't need to go out on these occasions. We really need, this is a highly transmittable virus. We've been saying that we want every American to know that what they're doing is making a difference, but we need to have solidarity of commitment from everyone to really, so, you know, maybe once every 2 weeks we can do a grocery store and pharmacy shop for the entire family. So it was really about, we have to do everything we can. I know I see on the TV stations the level of human suffering in the hospitals. Dr. Fauci and I and Admiral Girard have spent our lives taking care of others. We need to take care of each other now as Americans and do everything that's in those guidelines. And I know they're tough. I know incredibly how tough they are. My grandchild of 10 months got a fever of 105 this weekend. I'm the doctor, and I couldn't get there. I mean, so I'm trying to explain to my daughter how to listen to her lungs, how to listen to her lungs,
so
and then the baby's lungs.
There. You did not get there?
I did not go there.
Good. I'm very happy.
Because of you two. I mean, when you can't take that kind of risk with the leaders of the country.
Your grandson's okay?
So, daughter, but she's
that's
coming
out.
That's
a lot of temperature. One,
yes. But, you know, we're all, and that's just an illustration that I know you all are making sacrifices, and I guess I want everyone to take this seriously. So that was really a call of seriousness of how important this is and how we're starting to see the impact, but you can see what can happen when you come at this a little bit too late. And that's why the message, before you see it, before you have to see your hospitals and your emergency rooms overwhelmed, it is on us as a member of this community, of this country, to do everything possible to save one another. And so that was really what I was saying, and I will continue to say that because I do believe it's making a difference. You can start to see it making a difference, but we have to do even more right now because that will predict where we are 2 or 3 weeks from now.
Dr. Deborah Birx from Monday's White House briefing, don't go shopping at all if you don't have to. With me now, co-founder of the Children's Health Fund, professor of pediatrics, and director of the National Center for Disaster Preparedness at Columbia University, and the author of The Future of Us, What the Dreams of Children Mean for 21st Century of America, Dr. Erwin Redlener. Thanks for some time, Dr. Redlener. It's such a tough and also busy moment for you. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks, Brian. Glad to be with you as always.
And, you know, as a disaster preparedness expert, you always come on at the most fun times. You were on after 9/11, Hurricane Sandy, children in cages, now this. Yeah. And did I see you say on television last night that just as this is personal for Dr. Birx and the way she was describing there, this has hit your family?
Yes, very much so, Brian. You know, my son is an emergency medicine doctor who supervises but also does shifts at two large New York City hospitals. So he's very involved. His wife also is a doctor, and she's running some of the big studies to see if plasma therapy would work for patients who are very ill with coronavirus. But the thing that happened about 8 days ago now is that my oldest son, David, got quite ill. My son, Michael, who's the ER doctor, sent an ambulance for him. He came into the hospital, and Michael admitted him because he had double pneumonia and was positive for COVID. He's better now, but, you know, for a moment there, we were extremely worried about David, obviously, but and then he did get better spontaneously, was discharged 3 or 4 days later. But the thing that is deeply troubling or difficult on a personal level is that, you know, our son going to the, you know, to the front lines every day to, you know, work with many patients. He had a nurse that he worked side by side with for some time, developed COVID-19 and died a week and a half ago. So this is, we are completely immersed in this issue as a family as well as professionally. It's very, very stressful, I'd say, for the family, which I do want to say this. I think this is, you know, you mentioned some of the disasters that you and I have talked about on air over the years.
Mm-hmm.
They're always somewhere else, even Hurricane Sandy. We live uptown, and we were not affected by that horrible storm that affected so many people, mostly in the southern parts of New York. But we had electricity, and the restaurants were open. And even though it was in our city, it was still localized. The thing that's so incredibly unusual and unprecedented about this COVID pandemic is that it affects every single person on the planet, basically. Obviously, everybody in the U.S. It doesn't matter about your income level, what job you have. That nothing matters other than we're all susceptible to getting this virus. And at the end of the day, at least half of Americans will be infected by the COVID.
And yet we also have the emerging disparities by race,
yeah,
that the statistics are starting to show also by income, and we'll get into some of that.
Yeah.
But the clip of Dr. Birx, I guess with the story you just told of your own family in the healthcare professions and being affected,
yeah,
her main message to not go shopping this week at the height of it, if you can possibly avoid it, is to protect her colleagues in the healthcare professions,
right,
and your colleagues in the healthcare professions, as the virus is all around us more than ever in so many places. So I just want to be doubly sure that that message gets out and that that's the priority. Did you notice, too, that Dr. Birx said she, as a doctor and grandmother of a 10-month-old with a 105-degree
yeah
fever,
yeah,
did not go to the granddaughter's house because of, she said, you two, meaning the president and the vice president. She is totally isolating herself because she won't take the risk with the leaders of our country by getting herself exposed. And I guess the message there might be to treat everyone's life as equally valuable to the president of the United States if we have that choice.
I totally agree with you. And this is it's a very complex situation because we're looking to, obviously, we want to protect ourselves, we want to protect everyone around us, we want to protect our family and so on. And she's in a very unique position because she is, in essence, every single day coming in contact with, you know, senior administration officials, including the president. And, yeah, you know, the thing about this, Brian, is every single one of us has a story. There's not anybody that you're going to meet or know about that is not trying to deal with this in some way. And I do hope we get into the question of why some populations are more susceptible and getting more illness than others, because that's all important too.
Well, we can go there right now. If you want to do that, we can do that part now. And we've certainly seen these emerging statistics by race, apparently not cases, but by outcomes. Is this what structural racism since 1619 has wrought?
The legacy of what happened centuries ago has been extraordinarily persistent and resilient. In other words, we went from outright slavery to the years of Jim Crow, and then the residual has been this institutional racism and disparities that have become so ingrained in American life that it's just difficult to figure out how we're going to eventually get rid of this and become the nation. I think that the founders and many people, obviously throughout the generations and throughout the centuries, have wanted us to be, but we're not there yet. And then when we have a situation like this that affects everybody, but affects some people disproportionately, we have to really look at ourselves and try to figure out how we're going to try to go from here and fix a lot of things, including how we work with other countries internationally, but especially looking internally at ourselves and, you know, ask the question, is this what we want to be? And so people have asked me, and I've been thinking about, what is it about the institutional racism, or whatever, however you want to define it, that has kept minority populations and people of color at risk for so many things, including, you know, poor education, greater incarceration rates, and so on. But in thinking about it in terms of a pandemic, so if it goes like this in my mind, so if the prescription is you have to stay home, you have to isolate, you have to shelter in place. So for some people, I'm presuming you and I, for example, we can stay home. I'm not worried about my income. Columbia University will continue my salary. And that is just not the case for everybody. So people with lower paying jobs, with much less job security, need that paycheck, you know, literally every week to pay the rent, buy food, and so on. So when the general rule or guideline comes out and says you got to stay home, if there's not a remedy for that in terms of making up for those salaries that are lost, people are in trouble. That really goes beyond the kinds of things that you and I may be worried
and
about.
And not even just salaries, but the savage inequality of the risks that the grocery store employees, healthcare workers, obviously, police and fire and sanitation department employees, building workers and others are being asked to take, to go to work. How do you even grapple with the ethics of that as a medical person and disaster preparedness person? In the context of today's shortages of protective equipment, what are the best practices to protect essential workers?
And by the way, I think, as you just implied, Brian, the definition of what an essential worker is a lot wider than people think. It's not just fire and police and people that work in hospitals. But we need to have the people that are there in the grocery stores, not just the people that are the clerks and the salespeople, but people that have to come in, deliver the food, stock the shelves. All of those people are going to work while we're telling everybody else to stay home. And that's a big problem. Ethically, it's extremely difficult to come to grips with that, because we need to have the food. We need to have the trash picked up. There's a lot of things that we need that, you know, that are in fact part of the essential workforce, but those people are at risk. There's no at excess risk, and there's no question about that. But the other thing about low-income people is that they tend to live in more crowded conditions, and they may have multiple generations in a small apartment where the more the most vulnerable people, you know, older people with pre-existing conditions are living among with the rest of the family. And it's well known that African Americans and Hispanics have much higher rates of pre-existing conditions that have not gotten adequate health care, let's say. So all the cards are stacked against people of low income and especially people of color. And I think this is we've ripped the scab off a horrendous longstanding problem in America. So it's not just the ethical concerns of really asking people to put themselves at risk when their job is a low-paying, you know, sales clerk in a grocery store. But then we start looking at all the other conditions that make blacks and Hispanics and other minority groups at much higher risk. It's a big problem, and it's going to be part of the postmortem done about everything that went wrong and everything that was uncovered about by this terrible scourge of this pandemic.
I see you want to talk about New York City's call for volunteers. Can you describe it and the importance of it and the response?
Yeah. So the volunteer call has mostly been, as far as I'm aware, on the healthcare side. So there's been very aggressive calling for volunteers to come to New York and work in our hospitals and in various parts of the healthcare systems. And the problem here, of course, is that the people that come in and do this are extremely courageous. They're putting themselves at risk. They're putting themselves face-to-face with people who obviously have very serious medical problems related to the COVID-19 pandemic. But what I'm troubled by, Brian, is that the call for people to come out of retirement, doctors, nurses, and so on, respiratory therapists, come out of retirement and help us, I am very concerned about, because if they're retired, they're obviously older and they have higher likelihood of having some kinds of pre-existing conditions. So we're basically asking at-risk volunteers to come and put themselves in harm's way. Even if they're working in a hospital, not in the ER, but anywhere else in the hospital, they're still going to be at risk for contracting this virus anywhere in the hospital, because the whole place is potentially infected. More so, obviously, in the ERs and the ICUs, but the whole hospital. So I have been pretty strenuously objecting to asking retirees to come in. There's other options. One of them being people that are called IMGs, or International Medical Graduates. These are doctors. There's probably 50 or 60,000 of them in the United States who've done their residency and their training, their medical school, and so on in another country. But they can't practice in America until they repeat their training, their so-called residency training. I think that needs to be waived right now. So a lot of these people can come in, and a lot of them are very interested in coming in and helping out in this situation. So. But my problem has been with asking retired people to come into the hospitals.
Let me ask you about some of the medical stuff. 61% of deaths are men to 39% women, according to a stat that I read. Any idea why that would be, or if it's actually so?
Well, so first of all, I have no idea why that would be. But secondly, we don't know that for sure yet. I think the whole question of who's dying, how many people are dying from this disease, is another sort of open question. And until this moment, and I think they're going to fix it, the New York City Medical Examiner and the Department of Health have different ways of counting the deaths from coronavirus. So the Medical Examiner, when they are receiving a person who's deceased, calls it a COVID death if they tested positive or they're presumed to be positive because of symptoms. And the health department says we're only counting those who have confirmed coronavirus. So that has to be straightened out, because we have to have consistency among the city agencies, obviously. But the second thing, I think this is important to note also, and I've been pushing this in various places, but there are a lot of people that are going to die because of COVID-19, because of the pandemic who don't actually have coronavirus. And let me explain that. So that means that if a person who does not have the coronavirus but has severe chest pain and goes to the hospital and has a heart attack and cardiac arrest and doesn't survive, that person's medical care has been compromised because of the incredible pressures of the huge numbers of people coming into the hospital for coronavirus, and that interferes with the care of people who don't have coronavirus. In other words, this is not a great time to have to go to the emergency room for a condition that that may not be related to the coronavirus, but otherwise, if we weren't in this pandemic, you would get a certain kind of care, and it's not possible right now.
We're just about out of time, but I know you wanted to talk about the paradox of the leveling off of deaths or new cases and actual clinical realities in the hospitals. Can you talk about that? And then we're out of time. There is this sort of
Sure. Good
news, bad news in the statistics.
You know, if you're working in an emergency room in any capacity in the healthcare system, and you hear the news that, let's say, the number of fatalities in the last 2 days seem to be leveling off. So whatever the number is, if they go from 750 to 710 for a couple of days, it's not meaningful to you because you're still completely overloaded. You're still worried about getting the personal protective equipment. You're still worried about not having the ventilators that you need in the hospital. So the people that are following statistics, which are important and may or may not give us a signal about the trajectory of this outbreak, it's a different story when you're in the middle of it trying to cope with it. It's not like all of a sudden your emergency room's waiting room's empty. It's still jam-packed, and there's still a line waiting to get in. So for you, my only point was that data is not yet significant, A, and B, we don't know how long it's going to last that way. There could be a resurgence, and this all brings up the issue of when we're going to be able to relax the restrictions. Is it going to be driven by the overall large, big macro data, or is it going to be driven by what people are seeing on the front line? So we have a lot to think about going forward here.
Dr. Erwin Redlener, co-founder of the Children's Health Fund, professor of pediatrics, and director of the National Center for Disaster Preparedness at Columbia University. He's also the author of the book, The Future of Us, What the Dreams of Children Mean for 21st Century America. Let's keep talking, Dr. Redlener. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Brent. Take care.
Brian Lehrer, a daily politics podcast, is obviously also a daily coronavirus podcast under the circumstances in our country right now. We'll keep staying on top of things to serve you the best we can. And remember, this podcast is excerpted from my live weekday call-in show, The Brian Lehrer Show. If you want to be a caller or just hear it live, it's from 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time on WNYC Radio in New York, or online at WNYC.org. You can also tweet a question at us anytime. Just tweet at Brian Lehrer. Thanks for listening today.